very close to Buddha nature. It's like there's, we're originally enlightened, we're endowed with this perfect Buddha nature, and it's permanent and indestructible essence of mind, and we can't lose it. And but there's dangers in this kind of teaching, and there's some interesting new books, and some people at the Green Gulch have been studying. This is particularly this book, if you're interested in this topic, called Pruning the Bodhi Tree, which is essays by modern, mostly Japanese philosophers, or maybe like Buddhist scholars, about this issue, and also American Buddhist scholars. That's all about this issue of original enlightenment, and or like Buddha, kind of a reified Buddha nature, and the dangers in this kind of teaching. And they even, some of these essays even tie it into how these teachings were used during wartime to justify things like war and prejudice and so on. And it's a larger, complicated discussion that we don't really have time for, but this is the issue. This, you know, permanent Buddha nature. And I think that a place where it's quite subtle, actually, you know, the difference between Dogen's teaching and kind of prevalent views of Buddha nature in Dogen's time and since his time and before his time. But I think the best place to look, if you really want to get into this, and we'll do this as a whole other class maybe sometime, is Dogen's other fascicle called Buddha Nature, or Busho, Buddha Nature. And it's a difficult and long chapter of Dogen, but he quotes sutra saying, you know, all beings, maybe this is a good way to put it briefly, is at the beginning of this essay, Buddha Nature, Dogen quotes the Parinirvana Sutra, which says, all beings basically have Buddha nature. And that's, you know, a common Mahayana understanding. But Dogen turns that phrase, as he often does, kind of shifts it a little bit, that sutra phrase, and says, all beings are Buddha nature. Basically, it's like this. I'm abbreviating a little bit, but changes that have to are, and that makes like this whole world of difference. Instead of all beings have Buddha nature, like this indestructible essence of self nature, it's that all beings as they are Buddha nature. It's not like they have some like secret, essential, core, permanent thing. It's that they are the manifestation of living beings is what we mean by Buddha nature, and beings are totally impermanent. So impermanence is Buddha nature, and the sixth ancestor also says this. Dogen quotes that part and saying impermanence is Buddha nature, because in the sutra it says Buddha nature is permanent, and that's what this is saying too. Here he's quoting this thing that there's this permanent mind nature that will never perish. Mind is permanent. It does not change. This, you know, essence of mind. And it's a huge topic, actually. This could be a whole, you know, class series in itself. And then there's a whole debate going on to the present within Tibetan Buddhism about these different schools of middle way thought that some say the middle way is that the ultimate, or, and the ultimate truth is that there's, everything is completely empty and ungraspable, and that's it, bottom line, it's all empty. And then there's some schools that say everything's empty, and yet except for this kind of Buddha nature, this or nature of mind, which is different than, like, you know, just mental consciousness, but there's this mind nature, very same words even, that's like that's not exactly different from emptiness, but it's like a positive manifestation, and it's permanent, unchanging, and there's wonderful, amazing teachers on both sides kind of debating this point, because it's not so clear cut, but Dogen himself has, although he probably contradicts himself in other places, and mostly he comes down on this, quite, he quotes this kind of thing and comes down on this other side. So he says, or the question is, does such a statement as this accord with the path of all Buddhas and ancestors? And Dogen says, the view you have mentioned is not at all the Buddhist teaching, but rather the view of the heretic Seneca, which is brought up in maybe the Pari Nirvana Sutra or the Avatamsaka Sutra, quoting these kind of views. Or Seneca says, he quotes here, there is a soul in one's body, and this soul, on encountering conditions, recognizes good and bad, right and wrong. Soul here is, another translation says, spiritual knowing, something like that. That's literally what it is. The characters are like, in Japanese, rei, it's like, which is like spirits, or like the for that, like the Hungry Ghost ceremony, we have this tablet on the altar for the myriad spirits of the three worlds. It's that character, rei. But it can also mean like spiritual or soul, even spirit or soul, and combined with chi or knowing. So like a spiritual knowing or spiritual knowledge is another word he's saying is similar to this, like nature of mind. Here just says soul, but kind of a spiritual knowing is maybe less obviously strange. There's a spiritual knowing in one's body, and this spiritual knowing on encountering conditions recognizes good and bad, right and wrong. And it's what discerns aching and itching and knows pleasure and pain and so on. It's like this direct knowing. It's like the mind before thinking that can actually discern an itch before you know it's an itch. It's basic mind. And however, when the body is destroyed, the spiritual knowing, the soul, comes out and is born in another world. So, and it transmigrates life to life. And this is pretty much the same as like Hindu or Vedanta teaching. It was around in Buddha's time. And so basically Dogen says no. He criticizes this. And he...
So how can they say that? How can they experience that?
How can they say what?
That the soul transmigrates? Or...
Well, from a Buddhist standpoint, it doesn't work so well. But they, I think what they say is that very much like this, that there's, that this Atman, or like, you know, true kind of spiritual self, essence of a person, is this mysterious thing and it's inconceivable. So a natural question that would arise is, well, how does anyone know that it's there?
Yeah.
How do they come up with this if no one experiences it? And maybe they would say in very deep spiritual states of concentration, one might be able to discern this. Maybe they, you know, I haven't studied those teachings so much, the origin of it, but it was, you know, for thousands of years in India, and still this is the teaching. And I don't know if people know this, but, you know, this is, in a way, this was one of Buddha's most radical things, this teaching of Atman and the, like, the true self, but in this essential, permanent essence of self, was the total norm understood in Buddha's time. And Buddha came up with this idea of anatman, or no self, and no self meaning no permanent essential atman type of self. And I'd say that's amongst Buddha's most important teachings that really, like, you could say, I don't know, there are many great teachings of Buddha, but I'd say top three.
Top 10.
Less, top two, maybe number one, even maybe even number one. Or you can say it also includes and implies all the others. For example, like dependent co-arising, the 12-fold chain of dependent co-arising, and so on, is based on this teaching of anatman. They completely are completely linked. They're almost like this is the same thing said in two different ways. The 12-fold chain of causation says how suffering comes to be and how a person comes to be without there having to be this like essential self that, you know. And the five skandhas is also directly linked to the teaching of no self. The reason the five skandhas were taught, which are the in the Abhidharma class we can get into, but the you know, the five aspects that make that are, if you look for who you are, you just find these five aspects of, you know, form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness. And they're taught to if you're looking to see if there's a self or not, you look in these five skandhas is where you're looking for a self. And the Buddha's second teaching ever in his life, apparently, you know, is saying like, you know, going through the five skandhas, form is anatman. Form is not self. Feeling is not self. Perception is not self. So, which this is getting a little bit sidetracked, but it's, Buddha's not getting into this big ontological thing of like, is there a self or not a self? He's just saying, look for a self, and what you're going to find if you look for who you are is these five skandhas. And then if you start looking at the five skandhas, each one of them is not the Atman, not this permanent essential self.
Quantum physics.
Yeah, I guess you could say, could be. So, and this is coming down to the same thing. He never mentions the term self exactly here, but I would understand this question and answer to be the same argument. And another place this appears, the same discussion, is another early fascicle of Dogen a few years after this called This Mind is Buddha, or This Very Mind is Buddha. And again, it's a half of that essay. He's just quoting this view of Seneca, the same teacher, and then saying, which is, I think, because people heard this teaching, this which was a Zen teaching before Dogen, This Very Mind is Buddha, and they interpreted like this. What he means is, what that teaching means is there's this essential essence, nature of mind, and that's Buddha, that's true Buddha. And all our just thinking mind isn't really it. And Dogen, I think it's quite a wonderful essay because you read it and it's like, sounds really great. He's quoting this other Zen teacher, actually. And then he kind of refutes him. He says, no, the whole view is the view of Seneca. And then I thought that would be good to just mention a little bit because...
what's that in?
It's in, oh, maybe I didn't bring it. It's in the first book of the four volumes. This is called Sokushin Zeibutsu, This Very Mind is Buddha. But basically what he said, I think I talked about this in another talk here over the summer or something, but because that's one of these four tenets of the Soto Shu, right? This Very Mind is Buddha. And in that essay by that title, Dogen says something like, after he refutes that, you're like, well now, you know, the natural question is, well now tell us then, what does This Mind is Buddha mean then? What is the mind that we're talking about here? And Dogen, in his Dogen kind of way, says, well, it's the mind of like grass, walls, tiles, and pebbles. That kind of mind. So, at the risk of, you know, saying too much about this, because I think it's worth really meditating on one's own, but the way that, you know, rocks, tiles, walls, and pebbles, the way we experience them is mind, and it's changing all the time, right? Because there's a rock now, and over here there's a tree and a pebble, and so it's completely impermanent, and there's just dependent co-arising, right? And this is over and over Dogen's proposing this view, is that there's just arising and ceasing, and there's no essence behind anything, but the manifestation arising and ceasing, that's our life completely, and we wholeheartedly engage that. But we don't need some kind of like core essence that is never is born and dies. It's like, and this is, I think Dogen in some ways is going back to more like the early teachings of the Buddha. Very classical, thoughtful meditation on this that's cutting through a lot of maybe like new, flashy kind of teachings from his time about like original enlightenment and so on. And going, you know, and these kind of arguments I really feel like it really shows Dogen's very careful like contemplation about these important issues, and as a kind of philosopher being very clear. And in a way that's, you kind of have to read it maybe a few times to really get the sense of, well, what point is he trying to make here? Anyway, he answers this question here he answers it in a different way than rocks, tiles, and pebbles, and walls. He just says, I'll just read some parts. The teaching about cessation says that all things cease without separating nature and characteristics. How can you say the body perishes but mind is permanent? Is it not against the authentic principle? And he's saying that, you know, mind and body, why are you making the big thing about mind? Like mind and mind is dependent on body and body is dependent on mind. And everything is impermanent and arising and ceasing all the time, and there's nothing to grasp. And he also gets into this kind of big topic of not only that, but you should understand that birth and death, which is the Chinese way of saying samsara, is itself nirvana. And you know, this is another big Mahayana topic that usually these are like antonyms in Buddhist philosophy. Samsara is like the cycle of suffering, of birth and death, and delusion, and nirvana is like you leave the cycle of samsara, right? It's like ending samsara is nirvana. So they're like opposites. But in Mahayana, including Dogen, samsara, birth and death, is itself nirvana. So this is a big topic. And this Dogen also has a chapter called Birth and Death, Shoji. In which he makes this point again that birth and death is itself nirvana. And it very fits his Zen teaching, it seems also, that that actually this arising and ceasing life of each moment is itself freedom. It's not like you have to end that to be free, but to see how it's freedom. Also Nagarjuna, maybe he was the originator of this term. You know, in his middle verses on the middle way, he's got a chapter on nirvana in which he maybe for the first time says that samsara is exactly nirvana. Yeah.
Are you saying that it's seeing it is the freedom, that it itself is freedom?
Yeah, I think the quote is saying more like it itself is samsara itself is freedom.
Freedom.
You can say freedom is another synonym for nirvana. So this world of bondage is another translation for samsara. You know, the bondage of being bound by our delusions and hindrances is itself freedom, which sounds like one of those weird Zen things at first, right? But actually contemplating this, maybe one simple way to start approaching how to talk about it would be just this point that the world of bondage is just an interdependent thing. It's like, okay, so, you know, my particular, if you take a particular example, like, you know, I'm suffering because, I lost my watch, say. I'm caught in samsara now. But then to examine what's going on there, like I'm suffering because I lost the watch, like there's this feeling of like pain because I'm missing something, and then that I should have it, and like how that whole thing is completely conditioned, right? That like even, and that the watch is just a conditioned idea, and everything is just conditioning everything else. And to start to like meditate on it, it's like, wow, it's like an amazing miracle that I could lose a watch.
It starts to sort of...
Everything falls apart.
Falling apart. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that actually felt like this totally stuck thing of like, I'll never be able to like accept the fact that I lost my watch. It's just like, and that's a good example because we know, a year from now, we won't even remember that we lost a watch. We'll have another watch or something, right? But even bigger sufferings, to actually look at them in terms of, it's all just like, both the events themselves are conditioned by other conditions, and it's all completely mental idea. Our suffering is always conceptual. If without thinking, we can't actually suffer. So it's like, that's part of the conditions that suffering depends on, is the conceptual mind that makes a problem out of losing a watch, instead of seeing that having a watch, losing a watch, and being able to even like know what a watch is like a total miracle of being a person. And like, so an animal doesn't suffer about losing a watch, but like, isn't it amazing that we can like have watches and then like suffer over losing them? So to see how that works together is this, as it starts to fall apart and we see that like it's all just interdependent and impermanent, therefore there's this freedom right in the suffering of losing the watch, right? In the suffering itself, it's like suffering is this conditioned event, and it itself, when we see its conditioned nature, and therefore, according to Nagarjuna, it's empty because suffering is just a temporary event that's just the conglomeration. It's not quite the right word, but it's just the coinciding of a bunch of conditions. Therefore, it's empty of any like graspable essence suffering is. So therefore, that's the emptiness of suffering, which is nirvana. If you could follow that. Yeah.
What about physical pain? Physical
same, pain? Exactly
physical
the same.
Conceptual?
Yeah, actually. It's, and just like losing a watch is conceptual, but it's based on events, including physical events, like a watch is a physical thing. Oh, look, I found my watch. just like that, it's like, physical, what we call physical pain is actually a mental event based on physical, or what we call, even what we call physical is a mental thing, right? So in the realm of mind, it's like, it's like there's a way to have actually a sensation, a physical sensation that's what we would classify as like an unpleasant physical sensation, but it's not necessarily suffering until we put this conceptual overlay of like unpleasant equals not supposed to be happening. That's the conceptual thing, right, that we put on top of physical pain. Physical pain in itself, you could say, is not really samsara. For example, the Buddha saw through samsara. The Buddha was living in nirvana, we could say, and yet he had physical pain. But he had realized the cessation of suffering according to the teachings, right? It's like the irreversible cessation of suffering, which means that Shakyamuni Buddha was no longer capable of suffering, and yet he had like dysentery at the end of his life and back pain and stuff like that, but no suffering. So that's how we could see it, is like, and what an essential teaching this is for our practice too, right? Maybe the most essential after no self, but actually it's the same teaching. It's the same teaching, right? The very closely linked. Because if we see that there's not this essential self, there's just conditionality, there's just ever-changing, arising and ceasing of five skandhas, which includes the feeling skandha, which is pain or pleasure. So now there's like the feeling skandhas arising as pain, and but that's all, just like, that's all. There's not like the self that's saying it shouldn't be happening, or is the self beyond the pain or something like that. It's like we don't even need that. There's just arising and ceasing.
So is that kind of like acceptance? Like, for example,
Total acceptance.
If somebody loses a spouse or a child, and you know, they're really, it's painful.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very sad thing. And so, but there's some kind of acceptance.
Yeah.
So the person can go on, even though they're still maybe feeling suffering, so-called suffering. They're experiencing it. So
they can accept it even while they're having this strong emotional stuff happening. And this is part of the subtlety of in our practice, as we know, I think, as practitioners, and I think more and more deeply come to know that it doesn't mean like we're happy all the time, the end of suffering. One of the great quotes that I think about this point, because you mentioned like losing a spouse, right, is D.T. Suzuki, who apparently had this deep realization, and at one point his wife died, and he was crying, and one of his students or someone said, I thought you would like had ended suffering. You'd saw through the delusion of like this appearing world, and like how can you be crying? And he said, my tears have no roots. I think that's a beautiful way to say it. It really struck me as, I am crying. I'm crying, and like there's tears coming out, and there's emotion behind it. And you could say my tears have no roots, and the strong emotional feeling has no roots. Means it's like I see that it's just conditioned stuff arising according to like naturally. I was bonded with this person, and now they're gone. And so, in the human world of conditions, tears come at that time appropriately. Mm-hmm. Tears are coming, but it's not like there's freedom. There can be freedom in the midst of the tears, and because the tears have no roots, like they're really like this is really shouldn't have happened, and you know it can be empty. There's emptiness, but then there's manifestation at the same time.
Like sometimes your child will fall and start crying. You know they're really hurting, and the parent may say, "Oh, you're okay." And you know, I always think, oh, no, they're really hurting, you know, and you know, it's to accept their feelings. And then, you know,
and they're impermanent feelings. Yeah. So then, and in some ways, that's when we're really suffering. It seems that works the best to fully accept, instead of trying to change it, to fully like just cry when it's time to cry, and then it's like speeds it up in a way. It's like, okay, well now we're done with that. And now the next thing, the next conditions arise. And of course children teach this very well.
Yeah.
They can let go of their stuff because, they haven't solidified the roots so strongly yet.
And in a way, this is the self becoming the self.
And this, that self, is not the Atman, I would propose. That's the self, the ungraspable, essenceless self, the interdependent self, the self that's just the momentary self, that's just the coming together of myriad conditions for one moment, and then it's gone, that self is gone. It dies, actually. So that's the birth and death of self. It's the self of birth and death, the self that's born and dies all the time. But that self is total freedom. That birth and death self is nirvana, if it's seen in this way, that we're not trying to stop it from being born and dying. It's going along with the conditions without resistance as much as possible, which is also the wholehearted practice of the way and zazen, you could say. Everything comes down to the same thing in the end, right? But we have to go through all the different versions of it to be clear about this. You should know that the teaching that body and mind are one is always being explained in the Buddha Dharma. or literally body and mind one suchness. Therefore, how can mind alone leave the body and not cease when the body ceases? This is the point he's making, that mind is not some essential thing that carries on. And yet, Buddha did teach like rebirth, you could say, right? So here's another big topic that we maybe shouldn't get into. But I think it's quite interesting that he took this kind of commonly known thing of rebirth that seemed to work on the basis of this essential self that carries on as the body dies and is born. He could use that same teaching with the teaching of no self, no Atman, no permanent self. Isn't that strange? In a way, it's easier to, at first, on the surface, it looks like it's easier to see the Hindu way of like, yeah, there's this essential thing that's going through, and the bodies, new bodies arising and ceasing that are like hooking into this essential mind stream. But the on closer examination, it looks like the Buddha's view is more amazing, actually, and holds up more strongly, I feel like, but hard to talk about. But basically, when people would say, I understand you teach rebirth, right? So it's like there must be this consciousness that's subtle consciousness traveling from life to life. There's a particular sutra in the Pali Canon where a monk comes and says, I understand the Buddha's teaching to be this subtle consciousness. And we hear this kind of thing, even in later Buddhism. And the Buddha says, no, that's not, I don't teach that. And in the sutra where it's like, here he's going to finally explain his how he sees this. And after this long kind of argument about like, you're so ignorant that you think I teach that, you know, he finally said, then the question is, well, then how does it work? And you're like, okay, he's going to explain. And he says, he just goes into the standard formula of dependent co-arising. How does it work? When ignorance arises, you know, when there's ignorance arises, karmic formations arise, and you know, due to karmic formations, consciousness arises. You know, the 12-fold chain, and then that's the end.
But how does that explain rebirth?
Well, it's interesting. It's a good question, right? But I think it's something to contemplate. But if you look deeper, it's like dependent co-arising is the with no self. Dependent co-arising means no essential self, just conditions is the explanation of rebirth. So we had to get into the sidetrack,
birth,
I guess.
Though.
What's that?
It's birth, though, as opposed to rebirth.
Yeah, that is a good way to put it. And literally, you know, in the Sanskrit, it doesn't say rebirth. It just says jati, birth. Yeah, rebirth is kind of like an Americanization or something.
Well, it's more the reincarnation.
But even, I think to put the re is a little bit mistaken, which is why the original doesn't say re. It's just
birth and death.
Yeah, birth and death. But you could say it's like, basically there's dependent co-arising is like something ceases, and due to that cessation is a condition for another arising. So like, and every moment it's happening, like this body in this moment just ceased, and this is one type of conditionality, and that cessation is the condition for the next body to arise. And so you don't need a self for that, right? And there's other conditions involved too, but that's one of the main conditions. And the metaphor, I think, that works quite well for this rebirth thing, now that we're on the topic, is the candle and the flame. If you heard this one, but so it's like the candle, and maybe it ties into this, because you could say that sometimes they say the candle like the body in this life. Maybe that works here too. So the candle is like the body, and the flame is like the mind, you could say, consciousness. You could say maybe particularly like consciousness, and the candle is the other four skandhas. you know, different ways to look at it maybe, but you have this candle that with the light of mind, and now it's getting near the body, the candle's burning down and down, the body's getting near the end of its span. It's a nice metaphor too, because, you know, the candle and the flame depend on each other, mind and body, and the body supporting the flame and so on. It's a pretty nice metaphor. And then the candle's burning down and down, and then as it gets near the end, it's like, and you know, we're not going to get into how this other candle, you know, what's the relationship between these candles, but so this is going to be like the next life, and the so it lights the next candle, and then it burns out completely, and that flame goes out, and now there's this candle that there's a body with this consciousness, but now if you start, so it's a new body, it's not the same body obviously, but is it the same mind or consciousness? Is it the same flame that was over here? Well, it's kind of like yes and no, right? It's not really exactly the same flame, because that flame was dependent on this candle. It's not this, and a flame is impermanent, right? A flame is, that's what's nice about the metaphor too, is a flame is just a, it's just this, it's not even graspable. It's just energy dependent on this fuel of a candle and other conditions like air. And so it's like, it's not, you could say it's not the same flame as this one, but it is dependent on this flame. So therefore, it's like the relationship between these two lives is this life depends on the cessation of this life, particularly the cessation. Yeah, we'll just say it that way. This life depends on the arising of this life. Lit candle depends on this other life. And there's a relationship between them, but they're not the same. And, you know, how that ties into, like, can this flame now remember events from when it was related to this flame on this candle? We won't get into that. but if you contemplate, I think that metaphor for me has worked really well. And in terms of dependent co-arising, you can see how this could work. But it takes some, Nagarjuna is good for this too, this contemplation. So, if body, how can the mind alone leave the body and not cease when the body ceases? How can that candle, flame not cease when the candle is burnt out? But it can condition another flame, right? If body and mind are non-separate sometimes and not non-separate some other times, the Buddha's teaching would be false. Again, to think that birth and death has to be rejected is the mistake of ignoring Buddha Dharma. You should know that the so-called Dharma gate of the whole reality of mind nature in Buddha Dharma includes the entire phenomenal world without dividing nature from characteristics or birth from death. This is a nice way to kind of sum up his point here, I think, is that mind nature, because this is a Zen term by, like, you know, the sixth ancestor and so on, constantly saying you have to see self nature. Word kensho, it means seeing nature. It's the same character for nature. Kensho means seeing nature. Kensho. And this is saying, here it's saying, shinsho is like mind nature. So it's kind of funny here, because you might say, they do talk about, the Sixth Ancestors talks about mind nature, or self nature, even more risque a term when we're talking about no self. But self nature, constantly through the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor, he's using this term, self-nature and seeing self-nature. So when we say kensho, is this, which Dogen almost never uses the word kensho, and it's more associated with Rinzai Zen, but it is classic Zen from the Sixth Ancestor, who Dogen highly respects. And but here's a nice place where he's saying, well, what is this nature, or self-nature, or mind-nature, I'd say all the same thing, that you see in Kensho? And so the mind nature in Buddha Dharma includes the entire phenomenal world without dividing nature from characteristics, or like, you know, arising and ceasing marks of phenomena, or birth from death. Nothing, not even bodhi, enlightenment, or nirvana is outside of mind nature. All things and all phenomena are just one mind. Nothing is excluded or unrelated. That sentence is another kind of summing up sentence. All things and all phenomena are just one mind. Nothing is excluded or unrelated. This is the walls, tiles, pebbles, mind. Everything just arising and ceasing constantly. This inconceivable, ungraspable, impermanent, amazing thing that we call life. And there's nothing behind it. There's nobody like pulling the strings behind the curtain. It's just this arising and ceasing. And that's mind nature, according to Dogen. So it's not some special, you know, hidden thing that you see. It's more like you just see that there's nothing to grasp. Or mind, self nature is emptiness. I think it probably even says that directly in the Platform Sutra. And this is also called one mind. All things and all phenomena are just one mind. Nothing is excluded or unrelated. It's taught that all Dharma gates are equally one mind and there's no differentiation. This is how Buddhists understand mind nature. You are already the Buddha's child. Do not listen to the tongues of madmen who quote heretical views.
You got pretty strong.
Yes, yes. So this is a, you know, I think this section and this, and then this other essay that he has called Mind Itself is Buddha, particularly get into this point about what is mind, and it's, he's cutting down the view of like seeing this spiritual, essential, hidden thing, very precious, that we have to like get a hold of or something. It's like, it kind of opens it up that there's nothing to be grasped anywhere. And that's what we call Buddha nature, or mind nature, or self nature. Yeah.
So did I hear you say that mind nature is consciousness?
I would say no. I mean, it includes consciousness, but consciousness is one of the five skandhas, but it also includes all the other skandhas, as well as rocks, tiles, pebbles, and nothing is excluded or unrelated. This is the one mind or mind nature. So I think to say that it's consciousness starts to, even though it's not doing, because consciousness is impermanent too, but it starts to get, sometimes people use that word consciousness to start to get, imply something like this, you know, essential, unchanging consciousness. They start to equate consciousness with the Atman. Or like this, like in this early sutra I was mentioning, the monk says, as I understand the Buddha's teaching, it's that consciousness, vijnana, the fifth skanda, is what transmigrates from life to life. And the Buddha says, no. It's just dependent co-rising. But I think if we said, if he's in maybe more Zen terms, if they said, is it the nature of mind that's like, you wouldn't maybe say continues life to life, but is it the nature of mind that's actually manifesting in every life? You could say, yeah, actually there's that. And then there's a question of permanence or not that is brought up here, and he's saying it's not permanent, but and I think it's to make the point of not reifying some essential thing. But we could say, if what we're talking about is emptiness, is the fact, is ungraspability, we could say that emptiness is permanent. Yeah. That emptiness is also ultimate truth, and ultimate truth is generally said to be permanent. It's the only permanent thing in Buddha Dharma. But what it is, it's not something. That's why it can be permanent. Ungraspability is permanent because, just in the sense, it's not something. It's just the fact that nothing can be grasped. That fact never changes. That's maybe a clearer way to put it, right?
So, is this a statement about the nature of reality, or is it a statement about
reality?
How we experience reality? Is it an ontological? Epistemological state? Or is it
I think I would say that Dogen's generally coming from a more epistemological point of view, and that it's more about experience. And the Buddha too, although there's all these philosophical statements that sound ontological, meaning like having to do with like the nature of reality as opposed to experience. For example, there's some modern teachers who bring up this point, the question about anatman, or no self, is that, and say that it's not an ontological statement. It's not the Buddha didn't teach no self to be like, the nature of reality is that there's no self, which is often how it gets interpreted, especially in modern times. He taught it as a epistemological teaching that's more like, it's just a liberative teaching to see, like, it's not so much like, we don't care so much whether there's is a self or not, actually. Or we might care, but like the point is to be free from suffering. So it's just like, look for a sense of self, and you'll find these five skandhas, and anything that you could find that you might think is a self could be fit into one of these five skandhas. That's the beauty of the model. It's supposed to be an all-inclusive thing, so there's nothing outside the five skandhas. You can come to that conclusion if you kind of play this game. And then you see that each of the five skandhas is not self, which is not so much an ontological statement, but more like that the body is not who I really am. And in my experience. So you could say both, but I think all of Buddha Dharma is the liberative function is more like epistemological, I would say. So, yeah, and both Dogen and the Buddha don't, you know, explain this so straightforwardly. It's more like they're just implying dependent co-arising, I feel like, when they talk about walls, tiles, and pebbles. It's just the impermanent, ever-changing world, is Dogen's poetic way of saying it, and the Buddha's way of saying it when he was asked what transmigrates from life to life. He just went into his like stock formula of dependent co-arising. Dependent on ignorance, karmic formations arise. You know, it's like a psychological. Maybe Dogen's thing is like it's the natural world dependent co-arising of rocks, tiles, and pebbles. And the Buddha's was a psychological version of dependent co-arising. You know, if there's this mental formations, this is going to happen. But there's no, in both cases, there's no self. There's just rocks and people equally have no essential self, but they're both manifesting Buddha nature because that's just dependent co-arising, which is not limited to sentient beings even. So we could go on about this in this question and answer, but to keep moving. Now he's just going to kind of change, the questions kind of change track a little bit. They get kind of practical now. This is the practical part after that heavy philosophical part. Should those who are entirely engaged in Zazen strictly follow the precepts? Dogen answers, holding to the precepts and pure actions is the rule of the Zen gate and the teaching of Buddha ancestors. The Bodhisattva precepts generally, and you know, here the word pure actions, nobody translates it literally, but it's bongyo, which is literally, it's the Chinese and Japanese way of saying brahmacharya, which is, you know, sometimes equated with celibacy, but just pure conduct, well, pure actions literally. But but kind of tying it into the Indian teachings about the practice of Zen and the teaching of all Buddha and ancestors. But even those who have not received the precepts or have broken the precepts can still receive the benefit of Zazen. And so then there's this about the Dogen's view on the precepts, and kind of similar to this point that he's saying, I think it's nice. He doesn't get really dogmatic about this, right? He just says, you know, keeping the precepts is just like the rule or the style of the Zen gate or the Zen school and the teaching of Buddha ancestors. But like, even if you break them, you can still practice Zazen. So it's not like you have to practice them exactly. But he encourages them. And I think there's a really beautiful passage in the Shogo Genzo's We Monkey of like Dogen's kind of informal talks. And he says, this is kind of, I think, Dogen's attitude on the precepts where it's most, he doesn't talk about so much actually, but this maybe is the main place. And he says, you should keep the precepts and the eating regulations, which could be like vegetarian or something, and or not eating after noon and so on. But this is kind of equated with, you know, specific conduct things. And I think here it's, I think that represents the fact that he's not talking about bodhisattva precepts at this point. He's talking about monastic precepts, like you know, personal conduct precepts, you could say. And he says, you should keep them, you know, but still, it's wrong to insist upon them as being essential, establish them as a practice, and expect to be able to gain the way by observing them. And we follow them just because they're the activities of Zen monks and the lifestyle of Buddha's children. I think that's a beautiful, that's Dogen's attitude, I think. We don't keep them because you have to do it, or else you can't realize the way. It's like very practical, right? Just keep them because of the lifestyle of a Zen monk and Buddha's children. Although keeping them is good, we should not take them as the primary practice. I don't mean to say, however, that you should break them and become self-indulgent. Clinging to that attitude is an evil view and not that of a practitioner. And then he says again, we follow the precepts or these regulations simply because they form the standard for a Buddhist practitioner and are the tradition in Zen monasteries. So it's like, you just go along with the conditions. So if you're in a monastery where they're practicing really strict personal conduct precepts, then you just go along with that because it's the standard. And it's helpful, but you know, he doesn't even get into if it's helpful or not. He just like, it's just following conventions. It's almost like that.
It's how society.
Yeah, how society. Yeah, yeah. And he's saying, good, just go along with society. Don't like make, don't try to like, you know, it'll cause disharmony if you don't go along with it. And I think particularly our first pure precept in the Bodhisattva precepts that we receive is sometimes we say embracing and sustaining right conduct, but literally it's like, or I've been translating it recently as embracing and sustaining standards of conduct, and because it's Ritsu Gikai, it's like it's literally like Vinaya precepts. It's and it refers to like, it seems like it's referring to like the personal conduct monastic precepts, but it's received by ordained people and lay people. So it's like whatever category you're in, you follow like the conventional precepts for your group. And this is how Asanga, the Mahayana teacher, talks about that, which is the source actually for these three pure precepts. How he talks about that one, he's like, it's just the conventional, you go along with the conventional, and the other two are like these bodhisattva spirit. But it's like, it's almost saying, don't forget there's the conventional standards of conduct. But then Dogen says, for true attainment of the way, devoting all effort to Zazen alone has been transmitted by the Buddhas and ancestors. And then he says, when we sit Zazen, what precept is not observed? What merit is not actualized? And so on. This is the Zui Monkey, Shobo Genzo's Zui Monkey, which is like a small Shobo Genzo. Zui Monkey means like record of things heard. And it's Edjo's, this is really a moving book for me. I think this had a big impact for me getting ordained and practicing Dogen's way, because it's a very different flavor from the Shobo Genzo. Shobha Gaines is very philosophical and very flowery and like impossible to understand, and the written essays by Dogen. This is just these informal talks that he gave to his community, especially in the early years, and recorded by Edgyo just during before Eheji started in this other small monastery. And they're very just inspiring. This is more like Dogen. You get the sense of Dogen as a person, and they're very like a lot of stories from China about just, you know, and a lot about just like how to live. They're not philosophical at all, so it's much easier, simpler reading, but very moving, but like challenging stories actually. Dogen has such a strong sense of uprightness and virtue, and really, it's very humbling, I feel, to read this. And
can you say the name of that book again?
Zui Monkey. So this is a trans.
Spell that name. Of that.
Z-U-I.
Let's start again.
Z-U-I, Zui, M-O-N-K-I, Zui Monkey, and Shobo Genzo Zui Monkey. So it's like the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the record of things heard. And then there's, you know, the Shobo Genzo that the Bendo Wa is part of, these 95 chapters. And then there's another third Shobo Genzo that's the 100 koans, a collection, or I mean 300 koans. You know, Dogen's 300 koan collection, also called the Shobo Genzo. He liked that title. It's kind of confusing. But this is a translation by Shohaku Okamura that is my favorite translation. There's another one by Thomas Cleary, and maybe those are the two main ones, some older ones too. But this one's very nice with footnotes. And maybe it's hard to find because it's like published by the Soto Shu. We have it in the library here though, I think. Yeah, you can borrow. That's a lot, and there's a lot about poverty. Like so many things about like Zen monks should be poor. And a lot, yeah, it's... So this is then the next question is that he gets into is it all right for those who study Zazen also to engage in chanting mantras or a practice of calm and introspection? So this is like, maybe I wouldn't translate it exactly. It's more like he's saying to practice Shingon. So Shingon means mantra. Literally the word Shingon means true word, which is a Chinese way of translating the Sanskrit word mantra. It's like true word, or words that have power and efficacy to create effects. So the Shingon school is the mantrayana of Japan, or Vajrayana of Japan, the Shingon school, which still exists and widespread in Japan. The esoteric school, you could say. And then the Tendai school is the other big school in Dogen's time, Shingon and Tendai. And so the one of the main teachings of Tendai school is this shamatha and vipassana, was one of the teachings of Juri, the founder. And so you could translate it as, you know, is it okay to chant mantras or practice shamatha and vipassana, or calm and introspection? Or you could translate it as, if you're studying Zazen, is it alright to also practice Shingon and Tendai school teachings, you know? Can you kind of mix all these schools together? And Dogen says, no. When I was in China and inquired about this, I was told that none of the ancestors who correctly transmitted the Buddha seal in India and China ever engaged in such a combination of practices. Indeed, without devoting yourself to one thing, you cannot reach one wisdom. So, different ways to take this, you know, could be like really sectarian, or you could just say, just like at the beginning, you know, without engaging in incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, just sit. And you could say, but then you can do all those practices in the spirit of just doing them. So in this case too, you could interpret it as just sitting Zazen. If you're in the spirit of just sitting and practicing Zazen, which is like no gain. You're just doing sitting for the sake of sitting, and you're receiving the self receiving its function. Right? So if it's the self receiving its function, chanting the Dahishin Nirani, which we do in Dogen Zen, then if it's in that spirit, of course. And shamatha and vipassana, you could say, well, that's just another description of zazen. Some would say. I mean, we hear teachings on the shamatha, the calming aspect of zazen, and the insight aspect. Dogen didn't talk that way, because he's just trying to be so direct, like it's just one thing. Drop all ideas about breaking it into parts and categories. And yet, I think it's helpful sometimes to talk about shamatha and vipassana. So, but is that something different than zazen? So, then the other practical question of, should zazen be practiced by lay people only, or should it be practiced by home leavers alone? And he answers, in understanding Buddha Dharma, men and women, noble and common people, are not distinguished. We love this. Dogen's, early Dogen, right? Everybody's included, and you know, he makes the point in this question. And this is what I think I said in the class description, is like, he explicitly says this practice is for everyone. And then the next question continues, that home leavers are free from various involvements and do not have hindrances in zazen in pursuit of the way, the bendo. How can the laity who are variously occupied practice single-mindedly in accord with Buddha Dharma, which is unconstructed? Or this is, again, this word wu-wei, the Buddha Dharma of non-doing. They have so much to do. How can they practice non-doing? Buddha ancestors, Dogen says, out of their kindness have opened the wide gate of compassion in order to let all sentient beings enter. Who cannot enter? And then he mentions these examples of former times of lay people. Basically, these emperors from the Tang Dynasty had many obligations on the throne. Nevertheless, they practiced zazen in pursuit of the way, or wholehearted zazen, bendo zazen, and penetrated the great way of Buddha ancestors. And these ministers closely served the emperors, but they practiced zazen and entered the way. It just depends on whether you have the willingness or not, is the key thing. Or another translation says, it all depends on your aspiration. It doesn't matter whether you are a staying home person or a home leaving person. And then he quotes like this official who says, I enjoy zazen between my official duties and seldom sleep. Although I appear to be a minister, I'm known as a Buddhist elder throughout the country. And so, you know, he just brings out this this wide, opens the wide gate, and very encouraging to people in the world. And yet, this is at the very beginning, first thing Dogen ever wrote. And then at the end of Dogen's life, just before he died, he seemed to be like changing his tune a little bit, and wrote a lot of essays to the monastics in his community, which of course by that time had like developed, and it was like a big monastery, not so big really, but that was his focus, it seemed like, more than the end of his life. And so maybe it's just that the audience he was talking to had changed, but some people say, what happened to Dogen? Some people even go so far as to say he was getting senile at the end of his life, and getting kind of like nitpicky, and you know, what was going on there. And but I think more commonly people seem to say, and it makes sense to me, that he's just talking to a different group of people, and he's encouraging them, and he's saying, so I think that's another big topic, right? That, you know, leaving home and staying home, and what's a priest, and what's a monk, and what's a lay person, and all of this anyway, especially in a community like Santa Cruz Zen Center. So, but I think that Dogen says, you know, he's got this later chapter near the end of his life on the merit and virtue of leaving home. So he's, in this case, he quotes So if there is some difference, he quotes Nagarjuna at the beginning, and he says, there's somebody asks a question too, so to Nagarjuna, or in this text, and says, well, with these lay precepts and practice, we're able to be born in the heavens, attain bodhisattva way, and attain nirvana. Why is it necessary to leave home like this, right? And he replies, although both lay people and monastics can attain salvation, still there's difficulty and ease. Like this is
difficulty
and ease. So he, again, it's not some kind of like prejudicial thing or status thing or anything. It's a very practical. And I think there's something too that doesn't necessarily point to whether you ordained or not. It has to do with how you're living. So this is, I think, the interesting point that could apply to anyone. He says, lay people's livelihoods have all sorts of jobs and duties. If they want to concentrate their minds on the way and the Dharma, their trade will deteriorate. And if they concentrate on practicing their trade, matters pertaining to the way will deteriorate. So it's just like practical, right? They should be able to practice Dharma without selecting and without abandoning one or the other. So it's basically just like, if we leave home and the usual society and all these complications, it's called easy. But staying at home is disorderly and noisy with many jobs and duties. And it's called very difficult. So I think it's just this practical thing of like, and so if you're so-called staying home bodhisattva, may be possible to just actually live simply and don't create extra difficulties that prevent you from sitting zazen. It's in a way what it comes down to, even for Dogen, is like, do you have time for zazen?
Actually, in Japan, a priest has a trade.
Yes, and of course, this is why I think.
Here as well.
Yeah, so it's not so. Doesn't necessarily apply to like what kind of ordination. It's like how you're actually living. But later in this essay, Dogen says it's good to leave home in this, receive the precepts in that way, and. This is a kind of controversial point. He says, better to break the precepts as a left home person rather than keep them as a staying home person. That's really radical, huh? Yeah, that's controversial. And he doesn't really explain so much, but he says it over and over, and he's quoting sutras to say that. And my understanding of it, you know, could be a discussion, right? But as I understand it, it's like, and again, you could apply this to not necessarily the literal thing, but are you committed? I think this is how you could see it is, are you committed to practicing the precepts, you could say, and practicing the way? And so maybe he's maybe even referring to people receiving the precepts versus not receiving the precepts. You could also interpret it like that. Not receiving them, but actually following them. Maybe that would be an analogy, even though he doesn't say it exactly that way. You could say, I don't need to I already follow the bodhisattva precepts, so I don't need to like commit to doing it because I'm already doing it. People say this commonly, right? I don't need to do this ceremony because I already keep them. And then somebody's like, I actually don't keep them very well. I need to do this ceremony and commit to it, even though I'm going to constantly break them. And he says, that's better. And I think it's because like you're making this effort and you're constantly failing, but it's all about intention. You have this intention. Whereas the other person, their intention might not be that strong, and it's just like, I just naturally keep them. But then the next week, it's like, well, I don't keep them anymore, but I wasn't really committed anyway. You could see it like that, you know. But I think, you know, luckily, we don't have time for it. But you know, what is a left home person in America, right? What does this mean? We don't have all these monastic precepts, and originally it was all about the lifestyle. It was a different lifestyle, and what is it now? And was there some function to a simple lifestyle? Is there some function to simplicity in terms of freedom from suffering? which is what it all comes down to. I don't think the Buddha designed it as just, you know, that's just set up this like special club or something. It was more like, what's the really conducive way to actually like live day to day in a way that's like not getting all caught up in useless, unnecessary obligations and, you know, busyness. But as you heard, you know, it's like these ministers and emperors and so on, very, very busy politicians, had time for Zazen, and thus, you know, all of us can come here and like talk about Zazen and practice Zazen, and it's like amazing that it's possible, like manifesting the way of these ancients. So may it continue.